Good to see everyone this morning.
I couldn't help but think during that song, it is enough that he brought life, it is enough that he brought peace, it's enough that he brought joy. And the truth is, anything that he has done, it is enough. Because it's his plan, not ours. But knowing what we celebrate today, and thinking back in my personal life, I am grateful for the system that he has established. I am thankful for the opportunity to be raised by parents, to have a mother and father. I am thankful to be able to be a father to my children and a husband to my wife. I'm thankful for everything that he has established as his right and his good. His goodness is overwhelming. When we stop to think about what he truly has done in our lives and what he has laid out before us, how could we ever say enough about him? All right, today we're going to continue in Romans chapter 11. We're only going to be reading four verses. Full disclosure, I had, I think, another six verses, but by the time I got to page 9 of my notes, I started panicking and said, I do not have both services, so we will not go that long. So I could have stopped the verse early, but I wasn't going to stop in the middle of a thought. So I know that the English adds in their own punctuation where they feel it's appropriate, but I wanted to go to where that punctuation ends. And I say that because where we are and what we're talking about in chapter 11, it's very easy to lift and load and treat it as a separate thing, distinct and out of line of thought, and it isn't. And I know we've said this many times, so you're probably tired of hearing it, but Paul's discussion or argument or however you want to put it, builds upon the previous thought, and it ties into the thought process. So that is a long-winded way of saying I really thought about you and I cut down the verses that I was reading this morning. So we are only going to be reading verses 15 to 18. And it says, "For if the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead? For if the first fruit be holy, the lump is also holy, and if the root be holy, so are the branches. And if some of the branches be broken off, and thou, being a wild olive tree, wert grafted in among them, and with them partakest of the root and fatness of the olive tree, boast not against the branches, but if thou boast, thou bearest not the root, but the root thee." Brother Readout, it's so good to have you home. Will you pray for our Sunday school lesson this morning? Amen. You may be seated. Just one more thing, just because I have 9 pages of notes, that doesn't mean anything. I've had 9 pages in the last 10 minutes. I've had 3 sentences last way too long. But more importantly, I hope to deliver what God has this morning for each and every one of us. And that includes myself. So far in Romans 11, we have really looked at 2 driving questions. And these questions have built upon everything else, but the 2 driving questions are, first hath God cast away? And he's talking about his people Israel. Has God cast them away? And we talked about the way we feel sometimes is, you know, just because we reap what we sow, we feel like God is punishing us and wants to get rid of us, and it's not so. It's his mercy and grace. And Paul's answer is, God forbid. Matter of fact, before that, one of the verses that I want to point out is 8:35. It says, "Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword?" And the simple fact is, those are all external factors. Each and everything that he lists are external factors. And the fact is, there's no deviation, there's no changing, there's no multi-faces to our God. And we think those external factors are going to change him. And in reality, the only thing that changes him is how we perceive him by our internal. And the fact is, Christ is the fulfillment of the promise that he made at the very beginning. Knowing what would happen before the foundation of the world, it says he was the lamb slain. He is the sacrifice for all men to come to him. He does not change. He knows the end from the beginning from the end. He knows everything that is because he exists outside of the is. And we think that he is going to fail or cast us away. So the next question becomes verse 11 is, have they stumbled that they should fall? Well, if God hasn't turned their back, have they basically done everything necessary to be wiped out? Have they sealed their fate? And we looked at this last week, and we considered the following as the promise was given in a garden. The promise was given to Abraham. The promise became flesh. God knows what's going to happen. God knows what's going to happen. God knew about the rejection that would come from his people Israel. He knew about the rejection. And yet, he reconciled the world to himself. And we looked at the thing, and I firmly believe this 100%, that if Israel had welcomed him as God, his hands were not tied to have to be crucified for us. And I don't say that to denigrate Israel whatsoever. I want to make that clear. In no way, shape, or form have anything that I said should be taken to think that we think less of Israel. They are our brothers and sisters. Just like anyone else that exists, they are his people. We do not look down on him. They do not have favor. There is no difference before them before God, and there is only one way to approach him. So I want to make it clear, this is not me casting stones at them. They could have fulfilled and made him king right then and there. And what that points to is we have not handicapped how God works. It will all work to reveal him. Everything we do will reveal him. Just because they chose not to serve him at that time, he was still revealed. Had they promoted him as the true Messiah, the coming Lord, nations would have seen him, and he still would have been revealed to his creation. God can do whatever he wants except change. He does not contradict himself. And so the question was, well, didn't they fail then because, you know, they didn't recognize him as God? Does that constitute that he's done with them? And the analogy that we look at is the olive tree coming up, and that's what our verses were about. Did he chop down the olive tree? Not at all. He says, well, the failure of Israel is why the Gentiles have it. And I don't believe that. I think that's the way our translation comes across, and I think that's the way our thinking comes across. In plain English, God used what was going to happen to be revealed. And it so happened it was Israel made a mistake. That's where that stumbling is, the stumble to fall, to make a mistake. They weren't cast aside. So God didn't cast them aside, nor did their mistakes cause them to be cast aside. I know it seems like the same question, but it's two sides of it. It's one side, did God do it? And the other side is, did we do it? And the fact is, we don't, and he didn't. And Paul brings up, it says, when Israel didn't recognize him as king, this wasn't anything new. This was spoken to the people in Moses, or to, to the people from Moses. And we see it in Romans 10:19, but it's also a quote from Deuteronomy 32:21, is that I will drive you to jealousy by those people who are not a nation. The things that you say, that's only mine. Well, guess what? It's not only yours. It says, I'm going to save them, and it's going to drive you to jealousy. And we looked at that last week, and that word jealousy, that word emulation also means jealousy. But what it means is to see what someone else has and desire it, so you alter your behavior to get that same end. In other words, you didn't quite get it, but when you see how good I am through the acts of someone else's life, it's going to make you want it. The way we've been taught it is when you taste the fruits of his goodness, you say, I want to bear that fruit. Whatever I have to do, I want to bear that fruit. And then Paul says, basically, I'm going to do everything in my power to reach them, even though my call is to reach the Gentiles. And I'm going to do that by demonstrating how good God is and who he is, so that the Gentiles see him, so they serve him completely. And basically, I'm not going to pick my way to minister to those people. I'm still going to do what the plan of God is, because his plan is perfect, even if I want to do something else. My mission is to the Gentiles, and I have this burning desire for my people, but I am not going to go against what God has determined is appropriate for my life, because I know when I act in accordance with what he has revealed about himself, it'll be much better than if I did it myself. And that is a tough pill for us to swallow, isn't it? It is a very bitter pill for us to swallow. To think that God knows more than us. But Lord, you don't understand. If I just do it my way, isn't that where he found us? Doing it our way? How well was it going then? And this brings up to our main text. So this is where I'm saying is, we could just jump into the text we read and take it out of context and develop our own thinking about it. But he's not. He's still talking about this. Did God cast away? No. Did they fall away from God that they cannot ever possibly come to him? And Paul draws the analogy to the olive tree. And now this isn't new thinking. Paul again draws upon what we would call the Old Testament, or he would just say the Testament. And I want to look at two passages for that. Jeremiah 11. Starting at verse 1, it says, the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, hear ye the words of this covenant, and speak unto the men of Judah and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and say unto them, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, cursed be the man that obeyeth not the words of this covenant. Stop right there for just a second. I'm going to add some commentary because I just can't help myself. One side of the sword is demonstrated there. You know what the covenant is. The reward for not obeying is you are choosing the cursing. If God wanted to curse them outright, he did not have to provide the covenant. He did not have to provide a way to have relationship with him. He could have just let them be and by their own doing walked right to the destruction. Sorry, but in my head, all I picture is the old 1984 game Lemmings. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it was just this random level where you had a gateway you had to get these creatures to, and they just dropped out. And it was based off of the lemmings that just run off of cliffs at certain times of year. I don't know enough about the National Geographic, but the video game, you basically had to help them prevent themselves from just falling off of cliffs and get them to safety. The reality is, we are like the lemmings. If he didn't provide the covenant, we're just happy to walk off the cliff into our own destruction doing our own things. So this is laid out as the cursing here is if you don't obey the covenant. The flip side is if you obey this covenant, here is salvation. Here's how you avoid the curse. Here's how you get to the safety that you so desire. Here's how you become my people. It's very easy to focus on just what is said, and I hate to say this because I know it's a general statement, but we severely lack critical thinking. Everywhere. Everyone, myself included. And it continues in verse 4, which I commanded your fathers in this day that I brought them forth out of the land of Egypt from the iron furnace, saying, obey my voice and do them according to all which I command you, so shall ye be my people, and I will be your God. That I may perform the oath which I have sworn unto your fathers to give them a land flowing with milk and honey, as it is this day, then answered I and said, so be it, O Lord. What did he want to give them? The land flowing with milk and honey. That's what the promise is. If you just get on my program, here's what the reward is. 1 = 2. If you follow it, it's natural progression. Don't think too hard about the math equation. 1 does not actually equal 2. I know Steve probably has some kind of mathematical proof that would prove me wrong in some obscure way. But step 1 will lead to step 2. You obey, it's land flowing with milk and honey. And just to bring that back, that's not saying that there's a factory there. That means that the land is so abundantly fruitful, it is more than you could ever use in a year. It is so overflowing that your stocks and your storages will be full, and you will still have food the next year. We don't comprehend because we have stores. But farmers really did live year by year unless you stored it away for the following year. So when you think of flowing, that means every single year, not only will you all be fed, your storehouses will be full. And I'm going to take it one step further. If your storehouses are full and you are fed, you will be a blessing to other nations who don't have food. Because you're going to give it to them because his goodness is so overwhelming and so overflowing that you can't possibly store everything that he will provide if you just serve him. And it's the same thing in our lives. He provides so much, and we just want to bottle it up, and we want to put some away until, let's just get us through to Wednesday, not knowing that every single day his mercies and his goodness is new and fresh, and it's so overflowing that you cannot possibly use up his mercy and his grace and his goodness every single day. And we want to bottle it up, realizing that there is a world out there starving, that they are hungry. And we are fat and happy and content because the Lord filled me today and I feel good that I can make it. That, you know, taking a day off from eating is not really a sacrifice because we've basically pre-eat for years and years and years of his goodness. That we forget what it's like to be a famine of his word. That was all extra. That wasn't in my notes. So, then said the Lord unto me, proclaim all these words in the cities of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem, saying, hear ye the words of this covenant and do them. For I earnestly protest unto your fathers in the day that I brought them up out of the land of Egypt, unto this day, rising early and protesting, saying, obey my voice. And I hope the next verse was different. Every time I read it, I'm hoping for a different end. Yet they obeyed not, nor inclined their ear, but walked every one in the imagination of their evil heart. They chose the cursing. Therefore I will bring unto them all the words of this covenant, which I commanded them to do, but they did them not. And despite all this, God did not cast them away. They stumbled. But God still called to them. Otherwise, why would you send a warning? And the Lord said unto me, a conspiracy is found among the men of Judah and among the inhabitants of Jerusalem. They are turned back to the iniquities of their forefathers, which refused to hear my words, and they went after other gods to serve them. The house of Israel and the house of Judah have broken my covenant, which I made with their fathers. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will bring evil upon them, which they shall not be able to escape. And though they shall cry unto me, I will not hearken unto them. Then shall the cities of Judah and inhabitant Jerusalem go and cry unto the gods unto whom they offer incense, but they shall not save them at all in a time of their trouble. For according to the number of thy cities were there thy gods, O Jerusalem, and according to the numbers of street Jerusalem, have ye set up altars to the shameful things, even altars to burn incense unto Baal. That seems really harsh, doesn't it? They will cry to me, and I will not hear. Does that sound merciful? When you read the next verse and understand why. Because you'll run to me first, and if I don't answer, do you stay running to me? Do you still look for me? Or do you then run to your other gods? The harshness meets the hardness in our hearts. Thick walls are hard to break down. Little stones don't break our hard walls, do they? I hate to say it, but sometimes our hearts need to be sieged, attacked, broken down. The thicker the walls, quite often, the harder the lessons we need to hear. And why this might seem harsh to us, when we see why, how merciful that he doesn't overrun us. Israel, or Judah at this point, sorry, off the top of my head, the split kingdom, he could have just wiped them off the map. That would have been harshness. Captivity was rough, but did he still work in them? We see his working in his people up until the time that they come back and rebuild the walls. We see the working in his people from that time until the time that he comes to earth as Jesus Christ to call them. We see that cruel God who said, don't pray for them. We see that cruel God that today still calls out to his people and says, come to me. And we say he's cruel. Maybe our hearts are way too hard to recognize his work. Therefore, pray not thou for this people, neither lift up a cry or prayer for them, for I will not hear them in the time that they cry unto me for their trouble. What hath my beloved to do in mine house? Did you catch that? What hath my beloved? You don't call something you want to destroy my beloved. Don't tell me about his cruelty. Because I can tell you about our hardened heart. Seeing she hath wrought lewdness with many, and the holy flesh is passed from thee, when thou doest evil, then thou rejoicest. The Lord call thy name a green olive tree, fair, and of goodly fruit. With the noise of a great tumult, he hath kindled fire upon it, and the branches of it are broken. For the Lord of hosts that planted thee hath pronounced evil against thee for the evil of the house of Israel and the house of Judah, which they have done against themselves to provoke me to anger in offering incense unto Baal. This is what would have came to mind to the people that were reading Romans. This is the scriptural background that they would have when it comes to the olive tree. because they were looking for a Messiah to bring them out. They were looking for the promises so they would have known what happened to get them to the place that they had to look for the promise. They could have lived in it, but instead they were looking for it and missed it. A couple things. Judgment did come. They did not force God to judge them. They chose. They chose what the reward would be. The blessing and cursing of the sword. We get so caught up on that, we forget that the welder is merciful. We look at the sword because it is deadly, it is sharp. The analogy that it brings to mind is destruction or protection. I know whenever they knight someone, I wince because I'm wondering if someone's going to lose an ear. Because you have that sharp sword going from shoulder to shoulder. I think about the katana where you could drop silk on it and it was so sharp that silk would cut in half. And I think about the word of the Lord being sharp, cutting asunder and separating. And I think of the harshness of the weapon. But in my mind, I forget about the mercy of the wielder of that sword. There is harshness in the action, but not in him. Because yet there is a promise that they also would have known in Hosea 14. O Israel, return unto the Lord thy God, for thou hast fallen by thine iniquity. Take with you words and turn to the Lord, saying to him, take away all iniquity and receive us graciously, so will we render the calves of our lips. Asher shall not save us, we will not ride upon horses, neither will we say any more to work of our hands. Ye are our gods, for in thee the fatherless findeth mercy. I will heal their backsliding, I will love them freely, for mine anger is turned away from him. I will be as a dew upon Israel, he shall grow as a lily and cast forth his roots in Lebanon. His branches shall spread, and his beauty shall be as the olive tree, and his smell as Lebanon. They that dwell under his shadow shall return. They shall revive as the corn and grow as the vine. The scent thereof shall be as the wine of Lebanon. Even in judgment and captivity, we see God's goodness dealing with his people. We see it in the New Testament, in Acts. If he cast out his people, who were the first people that received the Comforter? Who were the first people that received his blessing? Who did Peter talk to in Acts 2? Let all the house of Israel know assuredly. Who was that target? Was it the Gentiles first? It was to his people. His people got it first, and they have to ask the question, did God cast them away? Did they stumble that they should fall? Oh, they stumbled, there's no doubt about it. But my God says, let all the house of Israel know assuredly that I am the Messiah. I am man in Christ. I am the fulfillment of what you were looking for and missed. I am him. We could stop at the I am. And we think he cast them away. Not at all. The Gentiles weren't added until Acts 10. And that's why that's probably this week's favorite verse. Because that's when it was for us. His purpose was before that, but that's when we see it demonstrated. God did not turn his back on his people. Nor are they condemned because they missed him. You know, we read about the branches being broken off of the olive tree. And I think of a couple things. First, have you ever tried to break a healthy branch off a tree? Now, I'm not talking a 2-inch one where you need to get a saw out, but have you ever even tried to break off like a 1/2-inch sapling? How well do those break off? Not very well, do they? Every time I've done that, I've gotten to the bark, and then when I pull the bark, next thing I know, I just pulled like a 17-inch piece of hangnail off the tree. They don't break off. Do you know what breaks off? Dried, dead branches. Those break off because there's nothing in there. It's dried out. It's easy to separate. You might have some stuff left over, but those snap off quite easily. If you're trying to start a fire, you're not going for the green sapling because it's just going to smoke. You want those dried, broken pieces because that's all they're good for. Well, unless you want, like, to make your own mulch, I guess. But it's useless other than fire. And yet verse 15 says, "For the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world. What shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead?" Now do you see the imagery of a dead branch being grafted in and made alive? That's what the picture is here. I can take a million dead branches and put them in every tree that we have, and those dead branches aren't ever going to do anything. If anything, there's a higher chance that that dead branch is going to affect that tree, cause a parasite, and kill those trees that I put it into. They're dead. They're useless. They're kindling. But not with him. Your circumstance does not change his ability to make you what he wants. When that dead branch is grafted into his olive tree, those branches are made alive by him. I can't help but think of the woman with the issue of blood in Luke 8. "And a woman having an issue of blood 12 years, which had spent all her living upon physicians, neither could be healed of any, came behind him and touched the border of his garment, and that would have made any other priest unclean." Anyone else that came in contact would be unclean. We have the verse that says, "A little leaven leaveneth the whole lump." It doesn't matter what it is. That little bit of touch on the garment makes everything unclean. What happened? And immediately her issue of blood staunched. And Jesus said, "Who touched me?" Not who made me unclean, who touched me? Without going into a completely separate message, part of the encouragement this morning is just touch him. "When all denied, Peter and they that were with him said, Master, the multitude thronged thee and pressed thee and sayest, Who touches me? And Jesus said, Somebody hath touched me, for I perceive that virtue is gone out of me." When we come in contact with him, we do not make him unclean. There is nothing else like that. Nothing else. You know, the next verse says, "For if the first fruit be holy, the lump is also holy. And if the root be holy, so are the branches." That first fruit was an offering to him. you don't give him an unholy offering. And you don't get a first fruit from something that is unholy. You don't take unclean, cut off a part, and now it's holy. It's not like the toast that fell on the ground. If it's bread side first, brush it off, it's clean. If it's peanut butter side down first, it's unclean. No, it's unclean. We just have varying levels of what we consider clean and unclean, don't we? There is no variness with him. He is holy. And when you touch him, you don't make him unholy. And that principle is there in this tree because it says, for if the first fruit be holy, the lump is also holy. And if the root be holy, so are the branches. You don't give holy first fruits from unclean lumps. Now, part of me says, I think Paul is calling back to the fact, this is the same word, lumps, that are made into vessels. I think he's calling back, as ministers often do, they get to a point and say, hey, do you remember this word that I used before? He goes, if you want to have clean first fruits, the lump needs to be clean. And, oh yeah, remember, you're the lumps that he can make vessels of whatever he wants out of your life. The fact is, you will not produce his fruit if you are not in him. Because the tree is holy, because the root is holy. So some of the commentators want to say, oh, the root here in the olive tree, that's Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. No. That's not the root. That's not the foundation. He is the foundation. He is the root. He is what provides nutrition to the entire tree. If the root is holy, then the trunks are holy. If the trunks are holy, the branches are holy. If the branches are holy, the fruit that comes out of those branches will be holy. If you change any one of those, it doesn't work. You don't get holy fruits if you don't go all the way back to the beginning and it's not holy through and through. Matter of fact, Isaiah 11 says, and there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. Who is the root and offspring of David? Lord Jesus Christ. He is the root. One more verse, Revelations 22:16. I, Jesus, have sent mine angel to testify you these things in the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David and the bright and morning star. He is the only one that provides life. Don't put me into a tree whose roots are men. If the root of your tree is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we can go back and take a look at all these people and see, where did they really get it? What was their foundation? Don't come out here trying to preach a different foundation. Don't tell me it's the foundation of Abraham. Don't tell me it's the foundation of Isaac or foundation of Jacob, unless you're going to say they built upon the foundation that Yahweh is God and Yahweh is Jesus Christ come down and revealing himself. He is the perfect translation of the eternal. That is our foundation, not the foundation of man, unless we're looking at that man to see who his foundation is, and that foundation is the Lord. There's a lot of things, well, I'm of the church of Paul, or I'm the church of Peter. Then you missed it. Then you completely missed it. Because their teaching is upon the foundation that Jesus Christ is God. Verse 17, resin, if some of the branches be broken off, and thou being a wild olive tree, thou, being a wild olive tree, wert graft in among them, and with them partakest of the fruit and fatness of the olive tree. We talked about those branches being broken off. The thing about most trees, when you break the branch off, you're not grafting into the dead part that was left on the tree. If I break off the branch, There's a wound there in that tree. You don't graft into that. Now, his tree is alive. He can graft us wherever he wants. But I say this is, we do not take the place of another branch. There is room on his tree for every branch. You know, I thought it really interesting because it says very clearly, wild olive tree versus olive tree. What's the difference? Tree's a tree, right? And then I'm thinking, well, it's just because you don't like olives. And I'm like, absolutely. Now you tell me whatever fruit you might like. In this case, I'll go with apples. There is a difference between a wild apple tree and a cultivated apple tree. You know, a cultivated apple tree is taken care of. It's set apart. It's spread out so that it gets the appropriate amount of sun to give you the best fruit. It's given the right amount of water, the right amount of fertilizer. There's enough put into it so that when you pick it and it's just ripe and you bite into it, it's like someone poured a quarter cup of apple juice in there. You want those juices to flow. You know what about the wild apple tree? Wherever that seed happened to land is where that tree is. Is it getting enough sun? Maybe enough to produce some fruit. Is it getting enough nutrients? Well, whatever it can get a hold of. Maybe a dead squirrel fell near it. I'm not sure it's getting fertilizer from the farmer. And you know, a lot of those, you're getting bitter fruit. That's great fruit. If I'm riding a horse or a donkey or, you know, have some animals at home that don't care what they eat, sure, free food for them. It's not something I want to consume. Same thing with olives. If you want the juiciest, biggest fruit that you can get, you want them that have been cultivated and taken care of, that they've spread out, that they get the appropriate amount of light. That way you get the best fruit that that farmer can get out of it. Wild, they got to be processed and changed to really be eaten. And even then, it's not the same quality. Smaller. Because those branches can't handle that fruit. They're weaker branches because they haven't gotten everything to get to the fulfillment. And what I found interesting, and I recommend the book, it's Manners and Customs in Bible Times, and I think it's Martin who wrote it. Either way, it does a very good job of discussing life and custom during Bible times of different things, different aspects of social life and various fruits and guests. And he talks about olives, and they say, you know, the tradition is, if you run across a wild olive tree and it looks like it's good, you know what you do? You cut everything off and then you bring in good branches and then you put it into the wild olive tree. Because those branches aren't any good. Those branches are useless. Even if I cut everything back and got the sun, they never grew to their full potential. So the best that I could do is I could take good branches and put it on this trunk that has life in it. That's what typical cultivation is for wild olives. It's interesting because Paul has the complete and opposite approach here. He goes, I take the wild olive branches. Us. Guess what? You're all wild olive branches. Way to go. We'll hand out diplomas sometime in the future. But we just discussed that wild olive branch is frail. It can't handle full fruit. It doesn't have the capability of bringing what that farmer wants. It doesn't have that capability to what the olive tree tender is expecting to get out. So you're going to bring it in, but you might only get 50% fruit, right? Yeah. If we're relying on our own trees. The beauty of it, the beauty of this analogy. He grafts us into him because it is his work. It is his fruit. And the root demonstrates its power by bearing its desired fruit in branches that have no business bearing that fruit. Those wild branches would never produce that fruit. And yet, he makes it possible for those wild branches to become part of that tree and support the growth that he desires. And but with it comes a warning in verse 18. Boast not against the branches. What I said earlier, we boast not against Israel. We boast not against others. I'm not going to just limit to Israel, but we boast not against any branch that is no longer here. We might see them as a dead branch. We're wild branches. We have no business bearing his fruit. Who are we to say anything about the dead branches that he can take and make alive in his tree? Don't think because you have fruit that it's yours. Don't think that you have fruit and that you're currently on the tree that you're better than any of these dead branches. Because any of one of those could be grafted back in. It is not us. But if thou boast, the root is truly not in you. And I'll say this, if the root's not in you, then you might not realize it, but you are a dying and drying branch. And you're one crisis away from being among those dead branches. Where do we get the most sticks? Around the church? When there's a windstorm. When you're no longer able to deal with the winds that come through. The chaos that comes through. You snap off. And those sticks that you were boasting against, that's what you are. It says, but if thou boast, boast in the root. Because if you're boasting in the root, if you're proclaiming him, then the root is truly in you. Our warning is that we have to look to his goodness, the goodness of the root, and boast about him. Last week we talked about needing to emulate his goodness and grace so others can see it. This is the warning that comes with it. It is very easy to see where we have come from in great distances in our lives. But the minute we think it's our fruit or our goodness that has brought us where we are barely hanging on at that point if we don't recognize that it is truly his root providing nutrients and keeping us there. Let us continue to proclaim that every good gift and every perfect gift is from him, and that he is the sustainer. And let us use that as an example to show others, I can't do this without him, versus saying, look what I can do. It is not what you can do.
That's right.
We were just wild olive branches. Let's stand and go to the Lord in prayer. Jesus, we thank you for your mercy to us. We thank you for your promises that you have made and you have kept. We thank you that you do not stumble when we do. We thank you for being our sure rock and foundation. We thank you for keeping your hand outstretched to us so that if we do stumble, you are right there encouraging us and empowering us to stand. We thank you for being able to demonstrate your fruit to others, that they might see your goodness. Lord, we asked that you change our perspectives so that we always keep in mind that it is you. That has always been you and always will be. Ask that you keep us in check, Lord, so that we can truly demonstrate who you are to others. We thank you for your reminder so that we do not forget. Lord, my prayer this morning is, let us not forget our utter and continued reliance upon who you are in our lives. We thank you for your word. In Jesus' name. Amen. If you wish to come to the altar is open. If you wish to be dismissed, you may be dismissed. Lord bless you and happy